Hello, you're listening to Lit Bits, the literary discussion show on Resonance. My name's Adam Smythe, and as ever, I am joined by James Kidd, sitting opposite me in the chrome and glass orbiting studio. James, how are you?
I'm very well, Adam. This is the last...
It's the last one. The end of the line. The end of the series. We might be back for more, depending on massive international financial deals and offers.
But Sponsorship.
I don't know how the whole Nike situation is going to relate to what we're up to. But it's the last one in the series. And each week we think about a theme that relates to literature in some ways. We've talked about literature and endings, literature and hair, literature and food. What's our, in this valedictory moment?
Well, we thought we should celebrate getting through 16 episodes of chitter chatter about all. We still haven't done trousers though, which I'm...
No, there's been a lot of pressure to do trousers. Trousers and gardening are the two ones we get a lot of calls about. But we're going to do literature and celebration. What are the great poems, books, plays that celebrate, express joy and contentment? And can literature do that? I mean, we tend to think of literature as having power in its capacity to express mixed feelings and to be a bit ambiguous, and that's what criticism likes, isn't it? It's ambiguity and ambivalence and the dark undertones beneath the apparent celebrations. Can we find works that are out and out celebrations, or is that just not what literature do? Is that what pop music does, or is that what football does, or you know, are there other places we need to look in culture for celebration apart from literature? It's nearly Christmas, isn't it? We should mention that. It's December, it's cold outside. Are you looking forward to the business?
I am, yeah. But it's chime with what you were just saying, I think, Adam. Christmas is a bit of a test of your ability to celebrate without any tiny bit of cynicism seeping through. I think a couple of weeks ago we talked about the John Lewis advert that came out at the, you know, starts the season.
I'm weeping now.
It begins with a small girl looking through a telescope and ends with the birth of the saviour, and somehow those two things are linked. But I remember as a child, and I've got a small child who's probably just vaguely aware that something is going on. She's very keen on our Christmas tree. And it's quite strange to witness her unadulterated, innocent sort of joy in lights and this man in large red trousers, and of course also Santa Claus as well.
Too.
And I do feel a little bit of that cynicism melting just watching it through her eyes. Yeah. So because otherwise, you know, I would be intent on ISIS and geopolitical strain and deals about climate change.
But even on the domestic level, just the fact of living through those two or three days over Christmas, celebratory days, I mean, it's a tremendous pressure, isn't it? Because of that need to be joyful and sunny, and it's the time when arguments burst out with most ferocity, and kind of repressions come kind of surging back through the surface, don't they? But if we're thinking about literary works celebrating Christmas, we think of Dickens, don't we? You've got A Christmas Carol there?
I brought my very nice, and in fact bought sentimentally, so I tend to read it during the Christmas period. It does get me vaguely in the mood. And I was thinking about there are lots of moments of celebration. Of course, there are lots of moments the opposite. But I think it's perhaps we need the bit of cynicism and the bar humbug to really understand the pure, unadulterated joy. So I thought I'd just read a paragraph from The Stave, as Dickens called it, which is the first of the three spirits. And this is just a paragraph describing Fezziwig's party. And I think this is the language of pure celebration. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig, top couple too, with a good stiff piece of work cut out for them, 3 or 4 and 20 pair of partners, people who were not to be trifled with, people who would dance and had no notion of walking. But if they had been twice as many, 4 times, old Fezziwig would have been a match for them, and so would Mrs. Fezziwig. As to her, she was worthy to be his partner in every sense of the term. If that's not high praise, tell me higher and I'll use it. A positive light appeared to issue from Fezziwig's calves. They shone in every part of the dance like moons. You couldn't have predicted at any given time what would become of them next. And when old Fezziwig and Mrs. Fezziwig had gone all through the dance, advance and retire, both hands to your partner, bow and curtsy, corkscrew, thread the needle, and back again to your place, Fezziwig cut so deftly that he appeared to wink with his legs and came upon his feet again without a stagger. And I think it's the language of superlatives, of
joy.
Of joy. And
winking legs.
Yes, and the sort of inability to quite say how joyful it is. Imagine how joyful it is, and then times it by 30 and you're still not close.
Like, yeah.
There's the rhythm and the speed and pace of celebration.
That's right, and you can't help but sort of smile and do a little jig as you're reading it.
Yes.
It sort of forces you into that spirit. As a kind of counter to Dickens, Raymond Carver wrote a short story called A Serious Talk, quite a famous story, from what we talk about when we talk about trousers, talk about love, what we talk about when we talk about love. And it's about a Christmas Day couple. If relationships are going badly, then Christmas Day sort of magnifies and amplifies them, like a kind of volcano. And this story is about an estranged husband who comes back on Christmas and tells his estranged partner, pays her some compliments, how she looks good in the cashmere jumper he's given her. And we find out by implication that he's disgraced himself in some kind of way. And he comes back the next morning for vodka and says, "Vera," he said, "it's Christmas. That's why I came. It's the day after Christmas," she said. "I don't ever want to see another one." That kind of sums up pretty much the terrible mood of that Christmas. And Christmas does feel always like you're right on a knife edge between those two, between the Dickens. It feels like a period when you have the fork in the road constantly. You're constantly faced with the kind of happy Dickens winking leg prospect, which is where you should be heading. But there's Carver as the other direction, and the coming back for vodka and the compliments you don't really mean, which just induce kind of snappy comments back, and the whole thing unravels. Joy and celebration and disaster never seem so close, it seems to me, at that particular moment.
There's something claustrophobic about the time as well, isn't there? Mm. That all the shops are shut.
Yeah.
The pub is only open for a brief amount of time.
Yeah.
And normally a group of people who perhaps, you know, you share degrees of tension and ambivalence with during the rest of the year, you decide to pack into small rooms and drink too much.
I mean, it almost feels that it's been designed to be psychologically unbalanced and explosive. And that's kind of the founding point of Christmas. And what could you do to make things as difficult as possible? Well, you bring in all your relatives into a small room, small flat. You drink champagne at 11 a.m. You sit and watch TV and eat chocolates. I mean, it's catastrophic. It's catastrophic.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Happy New Year.
Hey, listen, let's draw part one to an end. We're going to be thinking about different forms of literature and celebration after the break. But James, throughout the season, we've been very privileged to have Continuum, the house band, performing for an incredibly low fee, yes, given the number of people in the band. Are they here today?
They are here today. I think we are actually going to have to pay them at the end.
Certain
of
point.
But yeah. Take it away.
Take it away, and your payment in postage stamps will follow. This is Continuum.
Well, thank you, Continuum. Really very impressive. We are Litbits on Resonance, and we're talking celebration. It's our sort of end-of-season party.
Yeah.
We've got all sorts of hangers-on waiting to really get started. Adam, you've brought something to get us more in the mood. We ended that first bit on a bit of a downer, but there are other ways to celebrate which are perhaps less depressing and involved.
Yeah, I was looking back. I was kind of surveying literary history, the literary canon, the great masters of linguistic inventiveness, and Cool on the Gang came out top of the list. Their great song Celebration, which actually I do really like as a song, and I'll just read a little bit of this Cool on the Gang Celebration from the 1980s. And I suppose the question that it prompts really is we're used to talking about the banality of evil, but what about the banality of celebration? Is the text, which is joyful and celebratory, necessarily aesthetically disappointing and thin? Here's Cool on the Gang. Yahoo.
Sponsorship.
This is your celebration, Yahoo. This is your celebration. Celebrate good times, come on, let's celebrate. Celebrate good times, come on, let's celebrate. There's a party going on right here, a celebration to last throughout the year. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We're going to celebrate your party with you. Come on now, celebration. Let's all celebrate and have a good time. Celebration, we're going to celebrate and have a good time. It's time to come together. It's up to you. What's your pleasure? Mm. Everyone around the world, come on. And that, I mean, that's just the mere preface to a really quite long set of lyrics. On a certain level, it's kind of banal and quite poor. There is a kind of insistence in the happiness, though, that even though there seems to be not a hint of darkness or ambiguity there, is a little bit alarming. So bring your good times and your laughter too. Let's all celebrate and have a good time. It's time to come together. It's up to you. Seems to me there's a sort of policy of exclusion that's going on there, and that we can only celebrate and be happy and have laughter. That's a bit terrifying and quite Christmas-like, isn't it?
It's quite commanding too, isn't it? Celebrate good times. Come on, on. There's an injunction. I mean, that's always the thing about, you know, be spontaneous now. It's let's be happy now.
Yeah.
Whether you're going to have a good time, whether you like it or not. I remember that being a slight feature of the old Christmas when the mood dipped a little bit. I brought a little bit, which perhaps chimes with that, which is a moment from Woody Allen's black and white masterpiece, Manhattan. Mm. Which reminded me when you were talking about this banality of it, which is a moment towards the end of the film in fact, right at the end of the film, where he lies back and he's recording an idea he has for a short story about people in Manhattan who are constantly creating neurotic problems for themselves, which stops them dealing with more, as he says, unsolvable, terrifying problems about the universe. So typical Woody Allen. And what he does is he lists the things that he considers makes life worth living, and it's a strange thing to attempt to do. And his list, which I think is quite banal, he does quite a lot of stammering, and then he gets going. So he says, "Okay, for me, okay, what would I say? What, Groucho Marx, to name one thing, Willie Mays, and the second movement of the Jupiter Symphony, Louis Armstrong's recording of Potato Head Blues, Swedish movies, naturally, Sentimental Education by Flaubert, Marlon Brando, Frank Sinatra, those incredible Apples and Pears by Cézanne, The Crabs at Sam Woe's, and then Tracy's Face." So naturally ending with his underage, illegal girlfriend, Marielle, played by Marielle Hemingway, who is just about to leave for London, almost as though the moment he can't have her, that he suddenly wants her in very Woody Allen, in very Woody Allen style. But it's a strange thing. How do you describe what makes life worth living? I think it's a great celebratory list, but it's also its objects.
Also public things, shared things that everyone else has. And mainstream and canonical in a sort of Manhattan intellectual kind of way. You know, kind of Bergman and Cézanne and...
Yes, and there are things that aren't on that list. I mean, you know, family or kids, and those are things that character doesn't have.
So the list of happy things implies like the Cool and the Gang's exclusions, the things that aren't... that don't make it.
Yeah.
And that's in a way the real story of that list, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
The things that he omits.
And do we need things that we can put our finger on, or you know, we can reach to the shelf and pull out Sentimental Education, and that will make your life worth living. It's also, as you say, it's a very civilized list. It's not, you know, shoes and socks, a warm coat. It's difficult not to wander the streets and see people sleeping in doorways and think it must be hell on earth. It's a strangely sort of annoying list, at the same time seductive in its way.
There's that moment of seeming exactness, the second movement of the Jupiter Symphony, where he's plucking out with sort of personal expertise a particular part of something that's known. So that seems a bit more quirky and seductive. But in general, they could be any... You know, they could be kind of commonly circulating top tens, couldn't they? Groucho Marx. Everyone loves Groucho.
But it fits, I suppose, the idea of overprivileged people in Manhattan who are avoiding terrifying problems about the universe. It's another way that this character, who is, that's his sort of raison d'être, is avoiding those sorts of feelings.
It's difficult though, because it raises, I mean, celebration. I mean, the list is, if we're thinking about the different literary forms and their relationship to celebration, I mean, the list, as we've said, is necessarily excluding. I mean, it can pile in more and more things, but you have to decide what not to include. And when you feel great joy and celebration, there's a sort of endless inclusivity to it, isn't it? It's a sort of visceral, emotional feeling. You feel that kind of everything that's good in the world is kind of present at the same time somehow. And that's very hard to convey in words. I mean, I convey it through dance, but, you know, in words...
So when you're celebrating, you want to move your feet?
Yeah, I do. What about footballers? I mean, footballers score a goal and they celebrate. That's...
How would you celebrate a goal? I mean, how do you celebrate
Bafflement
a goal?
Bafflement and astonishment.
So the ball hit you so hard in the face.
It's gone in the other end. But they're funny, those moments of celebration, because they are very sort of artful and prepared. They increasingly, as the haircuts have got more... artful and prepared, so the celebrations haven't they? And there's somersaults and there's various combinations of Daniel Sturridge robotic dancing. And there's a fine line between the prepared, in which you look a bit of a fool that you've spent a lot of time clearly in front of the mirror practicing your choreography, and then this joyful moment of spontaneity. And it's sort of both. But I mean, presumably they are utter. If you score a goal in a football match, I imagine that's an utter and unambiguous moment of celebration.
Are they trademarked? I mean, the one I would like to go and see Real Madrid play, I'd probably have to go and see them quite a lot in order to see Gareth Bale score, just so I can run onto the pitch and beat him over the head when he does that thing with the heart.
Which he has copyrighted, I think.
Has he copyrighted that? Is that now a sort of... That's an image.
But that's that's expressive of where footballer is, isn't it? Football is... It's a moment of personal joy and celebration, but it's trademarked and it's a kind of global brand at the same time.
I just like that one, which is the sort of nonchalance of, you know, when Shearer used to score and he just sort of vaguely put his hand up. There's that one, but there's more coming where that one came
from.
Yeah,
it always had just a little hint of something very far right, though, didn't it, about it?
Well,
where he raised his hand.
But yes, that link between celebration and spontaneity, and I think that's the challenge of something like Christmas. It's repeated, so it's like giving someone a compliment over and over again sounds more and more insincere. So Christmas, we have to find new ways to invest it with real passion.
That's right. Milton never played football, but did write a poem about Shakespeare. And it's a poem he wrote in 1630, one of his first publications. I think I might be right saying it's his first poem in print. And it's Milton celebrating Shakespeare and saying what a magnificent writer he is. But it's also a very dark and weird poem about how Shakespeare is such an influence that he's a paralysing influence. And to the degree that it's a poem about one poet trying to work out his relationship with an earlier poet, it's a celebration, but also a description of being turned to stone as a result of the artistic literary depths of Shakespeare. So it's a good poem about the mixed mode of celebration. Milton on Shakespeare from 1630. And he's thinking about the ways we should monumentalise and remember Shakespeare. Should we have a big pyramid, or should we just remember him in the wonder we feel for him? What needs my Shakespeare for his honoured bones, the labour of an age in piled stones, or that his hallowed relic should be hid under a star-appointing pyramid? Dear son of memory, great heir of fame, what needs thou such weak witness of thy name? Thou, in our wonder and astonishment, hast built thyself a livelong monument. For whilst to the shame of slow endeavouring art, thy easy numbers flow, and that each heart hath from the leaves of thy unvalued book those Delphic lines with deep impression took, then thou, our fancy of itself bereaving, dost make us marble with too much conceiving. And so sepulchred in such pomp dost lie, that kings for such a tomb would wish to die. And it's an amazing poem. We shouldn't remember Shakespeare in pompous pyramids that will only obscure his remains and hide them. We should remember him through the wonder and astonishment we feel, but the kind of dark undercurrent of that celebration, particularly for Milton, the poet, trying to work out how his career is going to go. And he's always thinking about how his career is going to go. He's a complete careerist as a writer, Milton. But but here he's saying, such is the depth of artistic achievement, Shakespeare, that it does make us marble with too much conceiving. We think about you so much, and we can go on reading you, as we're told in the first folio, you know, read him and again and again and again. You can't stop, and it turns you to stone. And there's something kind of ornamental and beautiful about being made into marble, but it's not good also if you want to be a writer producing more work.
It chimes a little bit with when the episode we went to the British Library and we saw those wonderful Shakespeare books, but they were sort of encased in absolutely rightly behind perspex with burglar alarms.
But the security guards with walkie-talkies
coming up to tell us to leave.
Yeah.
But there was that sense of a Shakespeare at arm's length that does reverence somehow kill our sort of love. And there's something I was talking about this last night, that I love going to the Globe, which is perhaps the sort of cheesy end of some of the Shakespeare industry. But one of the things I love about the Globe is it's a bit messy. You're effectively in the mosh pit. There's interaction between the actors. It feels very real and visceral and sort of a bit revved up. And I like that bit of Shakespeare.
It's funny, the Globe, isn't it? Because it is this great bardolatrous thing. There is a strong sense of the wonder and the mystery of Shakespeare. And did he actually walk down this street? But at the same time, as you say, it has a sort of democratic impulse in that it's about breaking the fourth wall and the groundlings joining in and the kind of disruptive comedy of cheering the English and booing the French. It's like all that kind of disruptive energy gets contained within this ultimately kind of rather bardolatrous celebration of Shakespeare.
And they celebrate at the end, don't they, where all the actors have to dance and do that sort of hey nonny nonny moment. And I was quite like watching it because there was a couple of them that can't really be bothered and want to be in the pub. But most of them actually got a real grin on their face. And I think there is something, I do think there's something celebrated. It does break down your sort of cynicism and perhaps even that critical faculty that makes you want to think, well, actually, what we really need to be doing is doing the play backwards and how do we keep Shakespeare alive? But I think it does keep Shakespeare alive, but in a fairly straight on, straight ahead, uncynical, unskeptical way. Yeah. I like that sometimes.
Yeah, so it sounds like the more we talk, the more we're coming to the conclusion that dance and music are the mode of celebration and literature is lagging a bit behind in its capacity to
maybe deal with it. Should we try and find some things perhaps in part
Yeah, let's draw part two to an end. Continuum are back, refreshed. We'll have a little bit more music, and then we'll be back for the concluding part of the concluding episode of this series of Lipids. Welcome back to part three. You are listening to Litbits on Resonance. My name is Adam Smythe, and I'm here, as ever, with James Kidd. We're talking about literature and celebration. You've got a poem there, James, you want to talk about. What a great...
I was trying to think of writers that do celebrate life or celebrate a moment. And and you're right, Adam, I think it's in some ways it's more of a challenge to find in literature, because, as you say, I think most writers are interested in mixed moments, mixed feelings, perhaps at the moment of high celebration, wondering what sort of darkness lurks underneath. But I brought a sonnet by Gerard Manley Hopkins, but I think it is an attempt to describe ecstasy, wonder, and to celebrate, as he so often did, nature. It's called The Starlight Night. Look at the stars. Look. Look up at the skies. Oh, look at all the firefolk sitting in the air. The bright boroughs, the circle citadels there. Down in the dim woods, the diamond delves, the elves' eyes. The grey lawns cold, where gold, where quick gold lies. Windbeat white beam, airy abeilis set on fire, flake dove sent floating forth at a farmyard scare. Ah well, it is all a purchase, all is a prize. Buy then, bid then. What? Prayer, patience, aims, vows. Look, look, a maymess, like on orchard boughs. Look, March bloom, like on mealed with yellow sallows. These are indeed the barn, within doors house the shocks. This peace bright paling shuts the spouse Christ home, Christ and his mother and all his hallows. But I think even there are moments of doubts. Ah, well, this is all a purchase, all is a prize, which seems sort of slightly ambivalent about these glories. But I think it's a poem that tries to override doubts and override cynicism with the pace, the sort of flow and sort of flurry of language. A sort of slightly George Herbert on speed, pair, patience, aims, vows, look, look, a maymess. Sort of almost directing you to look and perhaps ignore other things. And
that's right, and I like that. It's desire to share that sense of celebration. It seems to be quite an important feature of celebration, doesn't it? If something joyful and wonderful is happening, you do want to share it, and you turn to the person you think is next to you and want them to see it too, and those lines, look, look, capture that brilliantly, I think. You know, I guess it's a sonnet, isn't it, as you said, and one way, if we were to kind of want to find buried other things going on, it would be to look at, I suppose, the tradition of the sonnet and its association with love poetry and poetry of separation in love and distance between narrator and object, and there's probably a way in which that sense of distance and unfulfillment might that's kind of inherent in the form of the sonnet might work, but also kind of undercut some of it. But I do love that sense of the way it conveys the fact that literary celebration, it needs to be a communal mode, doesn't it? One can't really... It's hard to imagine celebrating on your own entirely.
Do we read to celebrate? But as you say, it's difficult because you're in this very introspective, private space. I don't think I would if I really want to celebrate something.
Yes.
Beyond perhaps, you know, the kid being out for the afternoon and getting some peace and quiet, maybe a cup of tea and...
Yeah,
it's a particularly sort of odd celebration, a muted one.
It's an odd. It's just the kind of the mechanics of reading just seem ill set up, don't they, for celebration? To sit down in your chair,
perhaps Luis Suarez,
have your mint tea, and open your kind of folio edition of you know, the Odes of Pam Ayres. I mean, that doesn't seem a celebratory.
But maybe that's going to be the next goal celebration, as, you know, someone runs off as they bang the ball into the top corner and
get out Gerald Manley Hopkins
from the back of their shorts. Peter Crouch, are you listening? But yeah, I think it is a strange thing, a strange idea of celebration, that it could be quiet and meditative. It does feel at odds with what you really want. Lots of exclamation marks and some rumpty dumpty elves' eyes.
Yeah, that's right. But you can find, I suppose you can find the answer to that would be to find celebration in strange, weird, solitary moments. The kind of an odder version of celebration. The little joy or triumph. And this is Cut by Sylvia Plath, very famous poem. Which is a sort of that, I think. The small accident that could happen to one that weirdly becomes a source of a kind of joy. What a thrill, my thumb instead of an onion. The top quite gone, except for a sort of hinge of skin, a flap like a hat, dead white, then red plush. Little pilgrim, the Indians axed your scalp, your turkey wattle carpet rolled straight from the heart. I step on it, clutching my bottle of pink fizz. A celebration, this is. Out of a gap, a million soldiers run, red coats every one. Whose side are they on? Oh, my homunculus, I am ill. I have taken a pill to kill the thin, papery feeling. Saboteur, kamikaze man, the stain of your gauze, Ku Klux Klan, babushka darkens and tarnishes. And when the bald pulp of your heart confronts its small mill of science, how you jump. Trepanned veteran, dirty girl, thumb stump. It's a brilliant poem, isn't it? Yeah. About being, cutting your thumb when you're slightly drunk. But she's right, you know, you cut your finger and that weird flap of skin. There is a sort of, many feelings are felt, but there is, one of those feelings is kind of joy and celebration, oddly. And she's describing a kind of celebratory context in which this accident happens, of course, but also the thing itself, the pleasing flap of skin, is a source of weird joy and celebration, even though it's not your football team winning the league or you winning the Nobel Prize. But it is, nonetheless, a cause of joy, briefly.
Well, the other side of celebration is, I suppose, the proximity to some sort of accident, and then the celebration of just the mere act of not being dead or hurt, and yes. The way that your heart pounds. That's right. You know, you walk out in front of a car that comes to a stop, and for a moment, you know, the adrenaline's rushing, and perhaps you do need that sort of proximity to something.
Yeah.
Dark and, and deadly.
I mean, the sort of version of that you count on every now and again is the funeral, isn't it? I went to a funeral recently of a friend who died, and it was part cast as often as a celebration of a life in some of the talk, and I have sort of mixed feelings about that. It always feels like a bit of an evasion of the nature of the event, of the awful reason you are here, and the never kind of spelled out narcissistic thing that's going on in those events is that everyone is themselves having a personal celebration, that they're still there, they're still standing. One is down, and you always wonder who's the next to go, and it hasn't been you, it's been somewhere else.
It's a fine line between schadenfreude and perhaps lifting the veil of, you know, on the complacency we feel every day, that we just assume we're going to get up and make a cup of tea and get to work, and that's going to go on day after day, and then one day it won't. I brought a poem which I think does chime with what we've just been talking about, and I think in a very quiet, gentle, but very funny way, just remembers what it is to be alive in the most boring and quotidian kinds of ways. Frank O'Hara's Steps, which by chance I read not long after I got married at a party. How funny you are today, New York, like Ginger Rogers in Swing Time, and St. Bridget's steeple leaning a little to the left. Here I have just jumped out of a bed full of V-days, I got tired of D-days, and blew you there still accepts me foolish and free. All I want is a room up there, and you in it. And even the traffic halt so thick is a way for people to rub up against each other, and when their surgical appliances lock, they stay together for the rest of the day. What a day. I go by to check a slide, and I say, that painting's not so blue. Where's Lana Turner? She's out eating, and Garbo's backstage at the Met. Everyone's taking their coat off so they can show a ribcage to the rib watchers, and the park's full of dancers in their tights and shoes and little bags, who are often mistaken for workouters at the West Side Y. Why not? The Pittsburgh Pirates shout because they won, and in a sense, we're all winning. We're alive. The apartment was vacated by a gay couple who moved to the country for fun. They moved a day too soon. Even the stabbings are helping the population explosion, though in the wrong country, and all those liars have left the UN. The Seagram buildings no longer rivaled in interest. Not that we need liquor, we just like it. And the little box is out on the sidewalk next to the delicatessen, so the old man can sit on it and drink beer and get knocked off it by his wife later in the day while the sun is still shining. Oh God, it's wonderful to get out of bed and drink too much coffee and smoke too many cigarettes and love you so much.
Well, that's fantastic, isn't it? And Frank O'Hara has that just incredible capacity to convey the present tense, the sort of right nowness of New York. And also it has that sort of retrospective pathos in that, you know, not long after this, he's going to die in a terrible car accident. And that sense of the moment and the transient thin bubble of the moment feels even more fragile. But I think we're out of time. That's the end of celebration. There will be no more celebration. Thanks very much for listening. James, if listeners want more of this kind of literary discussion, where any sort of resource to turn to?
We do have a website with, I think, 49 episodes.
Plump and ready to go.
With all sorts of subjects under discussion. So listen there, stream, download, enjoy.
litbits.co.uk. And we're also on Twitter at LitBitPod. Do follow us, and we might follow you, depending who you are. So we hope you've enjoyed the series, and we may well be back in the future with some more literary discussions. But until that point, have a lovely Christmas. Celebrate, but with a dark, ambiguous undertone. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.